no harm, no foul, and it's one discrete sector of the business. So that's along the midpoint of the spectrum. And ultimately, Thomas, you used a phrase that I think is really good around the trusted advisor. And I know that can be an overused one. At the same time, I do think as we move along that value continuum, the trusted advisor role and function is really where most of us who are in the people business are trying to get to or maintain. Said another way, it's, do I have a seat at the table? And sometimes my colleague Molly used to say, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. Get yourself up in there.
Welcome to the Future Proof HR Podcast, a podcast where we explore the cutting edge trends shaping the future of HR, people operations, and generally speaking, the way we all work. I'm your host, Thomas Kunjapu, founder and CEO at Cleary. And today, it is my pleasure to welcome in L. David Kingsley, the Chief People Officer at Illumio, a leader in zero trust segmentation technology. Now, David, or LDK, has over 20 years of experience in HR, a leadership role spanning startups to Fortune 100 companies, global enterprises, and has driven transformative people strategies at these organizations as they've scaled up, and including supporting IPO readiness. In addition to the role at Illumio, David serves on the board of directors at Nivadi and as a board advisor at Founder Circle Capital. And just some further context on LDK, the career has, I think it's fair to say, it's has a trajectory from management consulting to Navy Reserve to HR leadership. And because of all this, I think LDK offers a very unique perspective on aligning people strategy with business growth and innovation in general. So without any further ado, welcome.
Thomas,
welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate LDK. It. Thank you to you and Cleary and for all of the innovation and dialogue you all are bringing into the space. I think you're doing a really important job, you and your team. So kudos and gratitude for all that. I think that all of us are on a journey to get better at what we do and help our organizations succeed and thrive. And we need thought partners like you and your teams who are facilitating discussions like this, then hopefully we can put some more ideas out there in the world and help us all grow and scale.
I appreciate that. And this whole enterprise grew out of like private conversations, right? I would have with folks in these kind of roles where you're saying things in private conversations, but maybe not out there more publicly, especially as new knowledge is being created because the world around organizations are changing so much, so fast lately. But before we get into all of that and how everything's evolving very quickly now, can we get a little bit of context and background on your career path? Because it's pretty unique, I would say. So maybe a little overview for me and everyone around.
The first and most important part about me is that I am the proud husband and spouse and partner to my wife, Erin, and dad to our three kids, Jack, Kate, and Maddie. That's the most important part of my identity. It's what gives my life meaning and purpose. And it is everything else in my life is in service of that. So it's important for me to just introduce myself that way off the bat, that that's part and parcel and core to who I am as a person. And I hope as a leader, as a member of a family and a community, and then by extension, a chief people officer in a scaling organization like Illumio, where we do, as you said, zero trust segmentation, cybersecurity, where we're on a mission to acknowledge the fact that cyber breaches are inevitable. It's not a matter of if a company or organization is going to get breached. It's a matter of when. And Illumio says we can help you when that happens, and actually we'll help you even before it happens. So when it does, when the inevitable takes place, it doesn't become a disaster. So that's our whole mission purpose in the company. But rewinding the clock a number of years, I started out in management consulting. I was back in the day, it was then called Anderson Consulting. Now it's called Accenture. But I was a PeopleSoft analyst. And so I was implementing PeopleSoft financial systems, general ledger, if I'm remembering correctly. So I was doing GL implementations for PeopleSoft financials and then moved into PeopleSoft HR system implementation. I eventually moved into the Salesforce practice at Accenture after a stint at Booz Allen in management consulting there. And round about that time, and this is about, 12 years ago or so, Salesforce called. And they said, we want to talk to you about this job in employee success. I said, what's that? And they said, it's what we call HR. And I said, but I'm not an HR guy, I'm a consultant. And they said, exactly. And we got into a really interesting discussion at the time that Salesforce was evolving what they call employee success into a new phase. And so I was recruited to lead the HR business partner team for the sales organization for go-to-market. It just so happened that because I was in the Salesforce practice at Accenture, I knew the product really well because I had been implementing Salesforce Service Cloud at a large prominent client whose name rhymes with Frisco in the Bay Area. And they said, hey, perfect fit, really interesting model. At the same time, I didn't know HR. I needed to really get skilled up there. And so I had a great team that I was working with. I went and got my HR certification through SHRM, took the test, all the things, and really got into the nuts and bolts of HR administration. Even though my background was really in org design, change management, leadership coaching, communication, the core things I think that is where the industry is really driving. At the same time, when you do the job that I do, and proudly so, there's a lot of work that has to be done just to make sure the thing stays on the tracks, right? None of us look good in the vertical stripes or horizontal stripes, whatever they wear in jails these days, I guess orange jumpsuits. I don't want to do that. And so the companies I work with, part of my core job is to make sure that we're running the company in the correct way, obviously in accordance with the law, but also in line with the spirit ethos of the organization. And that's a big part, I think, HR administration, in addition to the higher order org design scaling kind of questions that we deal with on a regular basis.
You got in. That first pivot into the function was specifically because we're not of the function. So then as you came in and started working there at Salesforce, and it's evolved since and over several organizations, has it been an evolution or a completely different point of view?
I enjoy both large format enterprise companies and small scale up startup organizations. I think because I never really feel like I left consulting, just to be really candid. I still think of the organizations that I serve as my clients. I even call them my clients. The e-staff are my clients. The CEO is my main client. Obviously, I'm the HR business partner to the CEO in my job. And those clients and I dialogue on what their agenda is in their business. And then I operate in service to that agenda and help guide and serve the people function to be able to pursue that in the organization. And so it starts out with hypothesis-driven approaches where it's saying, okay, where are you trying to go? What is the customer need of our company? Then by extension, what are we trying to deliver for that customer? Whether it's in go-to-market, product, engineering, G&A, whatever it is, we're doing something in service of that customer experience that we take out to market. And so I kind of work backwards from that question of what do we deliver to the market that our customer needs and values, back to how is the people team showing up to be able to enable and accelerate that. And that's the approach that I take to HR generally that I think has been a helpful lens to use on how we serve the organization.
Yeah. So it does map, because as a consultant, you are looking to be a trusted advisor to your clients, and you will typically have an engagement that you're really in particular focused on trying to move a particular number from X to Y, or you have a pretty focused kind of area. And yet, if I think about HR's reputation, it is not necessarily, at least universally, one of being a trusted advisor. So how do you see that role? Do you see that is an evolution that HR is moving towards, or is always ideal that always has been?
I'll just take a page back from my days in the Navy Reserve. If you go into any Navy office right now and you say, I'd like to talk to the people organization or the human resources department, they'll point you down the hall to something called personnel. And it's still called personnel, or actually in the Navy, it's called manpower, or not even people power, just manpower. Still using a pretty traditional, shall we say, a way of talking about the HR function in the organization. And no knock on the Navy, because that's where my heart is for sure. At the same time, there are a lot of organizations, a lot of institutions that are still caught in this idea that people are a necessary evil in an organization. I guess we got to have people and we got to kind of control those people. So I guess we'll have a personnel department. And it then by extension casts the people function or the human resources function in something I would say is just that. It's a necessary evil. It's only give me as much of that as I absolutely need legally and not an ounce more. And that's where that sits. It sits at the far end of the hall in the darkest corner of the building. And when you see one of them coming, walk quickly the other way, avoid eye contact. And if they're in one of your meetings, watch what you say, because if you misstep, they'll fire you. Oh, who wants to be around that guy? Me, I don't want to be around that guy. It then puts the organization in that light. Now, how effective can that organization be if it's perceived that way in accelerating the organization? Not very. So you're essentially taking X percent of your organization and putting it in a far dark corner and saying, don't come out unless I call you. You are required, but otherwise you're generally not useful to me until I need you, and only the absolute bare minimum. So necessary evil is the traditional model. And I know I'm being candid there with some frank language. And at the same time, I think some of your listeners and followers may say, yeah, you know what? I'm in one of those organizations, or I've felt that way, or I feel that way right now. or I'm interacting with a client who perceives me or my function in that way. At the same time, that client, they grew up in an organization that taught them that. It's not their fault. They're not a bad person because they think that's just how they grew up in the organization to perceive the people function. So that's at this end of the spectrum. Then you move along the continuum there. Some organizations have evolved to the fact where the people function is, I would say, a critical enabler. It's a, okay, they do something that's valuable. I really need them to run the business. And at the same time, I'd like them to stay in their box. And they're really important to us. And they acknowledge that. And every so often, they'll give the Employee of the Month award to somebody from payroll or something. And it's like, they acknowledge it. It's no harm, no foul. And it's one discrete sector of the business. So that's along the midpoint of the spectrum. And ultimately, Thomas, you used a phrase that I think is really good around the trusted advisor. And I know that can be an overused one. At the same time, I do think as we move along that value continuum, the trusted advisor role and function is really where most of us who are in the people business are trying to get to or maintain. Said another way, it's, do I have a seat at the table? And sometimes my colleague Molly used to say, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair, get yourself up in there. And that's true. We have to earn our right to be at the table. And a trusted advisor relationship is one where the client would say, hey, we're starting this meeting. And let's say, Thomas, you're my chief people officer. And I would say, wait a second, Thomas isn't in the room. We can't have this meeting without him. I got to have him in the room because we're going to have a dialogue here that I need his input. I need him to be involved. And we can't do this without him. Critical enabler behavior is, let's have the meeting and then I'll let Thomas know what we need from him. Necessary evil behavior is, oh, I guess we got to tell HR. I guess we got to tell them or we'll get sued or someone's got to fill out some personnel form now, I guess, call somebody over there, right? So you can hear and think about those different experiences and behaviors inside an organization, depending upon how the people function is perceived. And even by extension to that, what value they've driven, because we have to earn that right. If we don't earn it, we stay right where we are perceived. And it's incumbent upon us and the people function to do that.
And just to really crystallize the image in our minds here. So am I right in thinking of a VP who leads a function and has a weekly staff meeting with their key directs and management team, and they're going through whether strategic or people related or performance related or process related issues, or maybe it's just the generic all-in-one kind of session. And that's the meeting where you're talking about how that leadership team, what is their stance with regard to their HRBP, or if it's the executive team with
Yeah, it's an excellent articulation. And you can look at the organization and understand how do they value the people function by whom they have in the room when they're having a meeting. Now, that said, if you go into a room and the client does not have their HR person in the room, I would hypothesize that it's possibly the HR person has not earned that right. Because if I come in the room, and I actually had this happen earlier in my career back in consulting, one of my HR support team members was in a meeting with me and started interrupting the meeting. And I actually excused him from the meeting. It was being disruptive. And he was talking about whatever upcoming policies or program or something he had to launch. And I was trying to talk about forecasting my business in terms of what we were going to sell and how much margin we were going to make on those deals. And this guy's in the room and he wants to talk, like literally interrupting and saying, that's not going to work because we have to do whatever the performance management process sits right in the middle of that. And no offense, but I got to make money for the company. I appreciate you have a performance management process you got to run, but let's talk about making money for the company first and how the HR process is going to fit with inside that. And in that instance, my colleague had that kind of inverted about where the value chain was. So the likelihood that I was going to invite him to the next meeting, and I actually, in that case, asked him to step out of the meeting because I needed to get through the forecast because my lead partner wanted an answer. It's making sure that we're showing up in a way that we get invited. And when we open our mouths, it's in service of the business. It's not just because I've got a program that I need to tick a box on. It's how am I helping the business accelerate or deliver on its mission? And then I'm earning the right to be in the discussion if I'm speaking in that frame.
So now you've changed the topic a little bit from the demand expectations of HR from a leadership team, which you said has evolved, and maybe people have been trained different ways, or back when it was personal, that was literally what they expected across the board. But now the shoe goes also on the other foot. So it actually could be about how HR is showing up, because going back to your example about being a consultant in putting your Accenture hat on, you wouldn't go into a client meeting interrupting the flow on the goals. Actually, we need to talk about how this is going to impact my flow and what I'm going to be doing.
That's a great point. Like, would I get that follow-on work if that's how I showed up to the client? They would say, hey, I know we have a three-month contract with David and the Accenture team. I think we'll just leave it at that. Versus saying, wow, that team has driven so much value for our mission and our goals and our objectives. I need more of that. And are we being in service of the mission? Are we being in service of the client and their agenda? I think any good HR person should at any point be able to rattle off the top three things that are important to their client. What's on their client's agenda that have nothing to do with the people function? What are they going after? And then be able to say by extension, how are we supporting that?
So that's a great point. Instead of thinking of like your programs and like what we're doing in HR and this is our way of doing things, you're coming in with this expectation of being a client, right? And almost that, like, you can be fired from
every day I open the door to that building or in the Navy, we say, crack the hatch. Every day I crack the hatch, I'm interviewing for my job. Every meeting, I'm re-interviewing for my job. And that's not to put me on guard, on edge, but it's meant to remind me that I'm a cost center. And you're either a cost center or you're a profit center in businesses. And you should behave accordingly. And if my cost center is getting over its skis, it's not going to be a cost center much longer. Just being mindful of that if we're not driving value for the business, we're detracting from it.
It's incredible that you have the experience of being on the other side of the table as effectively a client of HR in this example, where you're able to see from that perspective what it is that you're doing. So then coming back to the HR perspective, if you are on that continuum where you're looking to gain that trust, maybe you're seen as somewhere between necessary evil and critical enabler because there's some kind of levels of paperwork that need to get done. And you really are trying to get to the level of being a trusted advisor. How would you advise such a person to go about?
Yeah, we actually, Thomas, did a little bit in the pre-show when we were talking about the power of open-ended questions. And how do we open the dialogue to the point where the client will share with you what's keeping them up at night? First of all, asking the question lets them know where you stand in terms of how you see your role. I'm here to listen at least twice as much as I'm here to talk. And when I do elect to interject or provide counsel or ideas or guidance, it's in the context of what I've heard. And I've found that clients are much more likely to hear what you have to say after you've listened to what's on their agenda. And it makes sure that it sets the balance in that relationship in the right way to say, I'm here to be of support and service to you. You are my customer. And in order for me to be of service to you, I need to understand where you're trying to go. What are your careabouts? What's keeping you up at night? And then maybe I do have some programs and projects and things that I have to get accomplished, right? We got to file a 5500. We got to file an EEO-1. I got to have a 401k non-discrimination testing. There's just stuff you got to do to run a compliant legal business, certainly in the US and certainly around the world and other jurisdictions, that you got to do certain things. It just have to be done to run the company in a compliant and proper way. And I do believe those things can be done alongside of supporting the core other functional elements of the business about where they're trying to go from a mission perspective.
So we've talked a lot about your personal experience coming in from the consulting world, impacting how you think about the evolution of HR or how you imagine it being the highest level expression of it might be as a trusted advisor. But the other aspect of the role's evolution in the last, let's say, 5 years, there's been a lot of things that have been happening in the world, starting with COVID and remote work, different expectations from both leadership teams as well as employees around what they need from the workforce, board level expectations changing and the interaction maybe for the first time of CHROs with boards. So a lot of shifts have been happening. In some ways, the role has been elevated. In this time, do you think HR or the people function has been adding value beyond used to do traditionally because of all these opportunities?
It's an interesting juxtaposition, I think, that's happened in the industry over the last 3 or 4 years. And we all remember that week that we all went into lockdown back in, I guess it was March of 2020. And I call it the snow day. So anybody who's from the East Coast, I grew up on the East Coast of the US, when it snows, the schools close sometimes. The buses can't run, parents can't get carpool, whatever. And so you stay home from school that day and you get a snow day. And I think we all thought it was going to be kind of like that. Okay, everybody go home from the office. there's this COVID-19 SARS thing. It's going to blow over in a few days. We'll see everybody back in the office on Monday. That's what we thought. Then fast forward, it's like, oh, this is like a thing. And all of a sudden, we all had to learn how to run our businesses solely on Zoom. And people were scrambling to try and get cameras, and then also trying to get toilet paper and Clorox wipes and every manner of things that you needed. We were all in this era of uncertainty and scarcity. And at the same time, we had this abundance of time on our hands to be on a computer. People were working more hours than ever. They were logging on at 7:45, because that was the time they used to leave for work to commute, and they would stay on until 6:30. And folks were starting to get burnout. Now, at the same time, we started opening offices back up a little bit. We could meet with masks and whatever else. So then all of a sudden, chief people officers, we became like health officers. I was like a mask technician, testing official, social distancing executive. I don't know. I don't have a degree in biology. Like, how all of a sudden am I in charge of all this stuff? And at the same time, like, what happened was this was about people.
Right.
And so they reached for the people organizations and help us run our organizations fully remotely, or in some cases, hybrid or defined hybrid, and also keep people engaged through this. And oh, by the way, the barriers to enter and exit from organizations went to zero. So you and I could be on this call right now. And after we get off this call, one of the colleagues on the call with us, they could be interviewing for a job somewhere else. And then 2 days later, they resign. And we're like, where did that happen? We were just on a strategic planning call 2 days ago. Their brain, their heart wasn't on a strategic planning call. Their mind and mouth was, but their heart wasn't. We didn't know that. And so we had to navigate those waters. Also, we were all really mindful of our cost management at that time. So as the economy ebbed and flowed through that journey, companies really took a look at where their costs were. And many companies did some reductions in force. Some in the product mission side, some in go-to-market, some in G&A. In doing that, I think what happened was previously we would run HR functions. We would be about, if you take your total cost of workforce, it was about 4-6% of running your company was in the HR function. That has now shifted to, I think, more like 3-5%. So it's moved down anywhere from 50 to a couple hundred basis points, depending upon the organization. That, frankly, is a little bit of at least do the same with less. And I would even say do less with less, because some of the more that we were doing was maybe not fully aligned with the needs of the business. I'll give you an example. And I think we've done a good job course correcting on this, that learning and development functions, if you rewind the clock 5-6 years ago, the learning and development function, I've shared this with my own team, would be offering a set of, let's say, 15 courses a year, right? And you go into one of those courses, you log on, and it's this super energetic facilitator who's like taking up the full screen with loud voice and a lot of caffeine, and 6 people on the training. And 4 of whom had their videos off the whole time, 1 of whom had it on and off when they were talking, and the 6th person was probably on the HR team themselves and was going to show face in the training. So we were hosting all these trainings, all these enablements, all these classes that I think I'll personalize this, thought were good for the business. Oh, we got to have this training. The business didn't want it. They never asked for it. I never articulated why you needed to do it in a real business sense. I just thought to be a good HR person, we got to have these 10 training classes. Here we go. And people either didn't come, or they came and multitasked, or they came and then forgot what it was and they never applied it because they didn't actually need that thing to begin with. All those courses were valid, valuable content, just maybe in the context of that company or that moment in time, it wasn't quite there. So that's one of the areas I think that we've seen some reduction in focus in organizations. It's now much more incumbent upon local leaders to be doing on-the-job training, social learning, those kind of things, and then also self-paced learning with new content that's available every day now through the advent of AI learning. So that's been a shift in the business in terms of the costs that I think is part of our new normal, if you will.
So I've definitely heard the phrase do more with less. Do less with less is an intriguing variation of that. Do you think there's been this, almost like a loss for the HR people function of an opportunity where there was increased demand for services from this trusted advisor for all types of services to really elevate people and the organization overall in the early COVID era, which then evolved very much in the opposite direction. Maybe it's more about doing more with less or doing less with less in the end of ZIRP and the shrinking of budgets kind of era. Does that mean that there was a hole that the people function didn't successfully, by and large, convince executive teams of the incremental value that could be added with actually keeping budgets or increasing budgets in some kind of way as a ratio?
Yeah, I think it varies by organization. And I think that it's put a bright light on the need for us to, as we were saying a few minutes ago, earn the right and earn our job every day. Am I walking in and delivering value to the organization in a way that you're going to have me back tomorrow, have me back in the next meeting? I think that what a benefit that it has done for us is it's given us the opportunity to clarify our mission, clarify our value proposition to the business, and then remove anything that is otherwise extraneous. Because if I'm asking for a moment of an employee's time in the company, I'm asking them to not do something else. So what we say no to is as important to the things we say yes to. And if I'm asking them to say yes to all my programs and projects, I got to make darn sure that it's adding as much or more value than they would be doing with that minute or hour or day otherwise in the business. And that's frankly a pretty high bar when you think about a software engineer. So that person could be debugging code or writing new feature functionality for a customer who's looking to buy our products or services or add more, right? If it's a cross-sell, upsell opportunity. So that engineer could go be doing that, or they could be talking to me in the people function. I'm not saying that one is better than the other. It's just we've got to make sure that they're in the right context and in the right measure of effort in the organization. And I think that the end of ZIRP has now meant that every moment is even more precious than it ever was in an organization because the money's not free anymore. The funding's not free or nearly free like it was some years ago. And frankly, I think we're in a much more sustainable model now in terms of how companies are looking at how they run themselves, how they fund themselves, where investors in the market are looking at. We're getting a lot back to basics. And the basics worked for several hundred years of modern commercial business where shareholders deserve to have value delivered and returned to them on a regular and sustained basis.
To your point, it is going to vary by organization. But if you were to draw out some generalities that you see about that core mission, like what is that core mission for HR teams moving forward, right? And or the opposite of that would be what were some things that may not make as much sense, at least globally, yeah, for most.
It's interesting. There was an article that Harvard Business Review ran, and this may be a bit provocative, so I'll ask the listeners to bear with us here. But Harvard Business Review ran a piece a while ago, and it was talking about how companies were failing to meet the mark on the value of belonging at work. That's the title of the article, The Value of Belonging at Work. And the comment that the writers were making was that many companies were investing in DEI training that was failing to create belonging in the workplace. And that article ran in 2019, which was really in the thick of a lot of focus on DEI training, mandatory training, anti this, pro that, et cetera. The goal of all that, I think, is very virtuous. It's to make our companies and organizations more inclusive and equitable places to work. What they, or maybe we, failed to do was recognize that it's actually belonging that creates the inclusion and drives value for the organizations. And again, that was in 2019. So 5 years ago, Harvard Business Review was already having that discussion or engendering that discussion in us. So I think that's been something that has now been an evolution or a pivot, certainly that I'm making inside of Illumio to focus on the nature of belonging. When you have a culture that indexes on belonging, it is a culture that is inclusive. It is a culture that is diverse. It is a culture that embraces everyone for who they are and how they show up to work. So it's looking at the topic through the other side of the lens. Instead of me hosting a bunch of training classes that are just browbeating people to performatively check a box that they came to a training, it's more around how are we setting the values and the culture and the behaviors in an organization that deliver belonging, that are rooted in being valued at work and being connected to a mission that gives someone meaningful work to do, purpose in their life, and then contribution to something greater than themselves. very different lens on things than we had several years ago.
Interesting. So then would you say that is a broad sweep observation you would make, or something specific?
I think it's something that all of us are called to look at in the people business. And it's really, there's been this epidemic of disengagement, I think back earlier to your point, Thomas, that started during COVID, that people were feeling separate from the mission of their organization. They weren't seeing as much purpose in their work as they had before. Some people could say, hey, it's because you're not around other people. Companies moving too fast. Some companies showed their true colors about, we used to say, oh, we're a family and you're part of the family. And then we just lopped off a third of the workforce. It's like, we just fire our family members. Now, granted, there are maybe some members of my family who'd like to fire me from the family, maybe. But at the end of the day, we don't do that. Family's a family. Companies aren't families. Companies are, the better analogy, I think, is a professional sports team, that we have a goal and objective. We get the best people we can. We run plays. If someone's falling behind, we help them. We coach them. We get them skilled up to get back in the game. If it doesn't work, guess what? They get traded. They go out of the minor leagues, whatever it is. This is a professional sports team. It's not a family. So I think the recognition of that is important, and that's happening throughout industry, throughout companies. And then the criticality of focusing on purpose and mission inside the organization that then drives folks' attachment to the company and the organization, and the ability to really have a sense of belonging of, do I matter here? How can I tell someone they matter here if I don't even tell them what the heck we do or what they do or why that has import to the business? So I think it's pretty broad. I don't want to broad brush every company everywhere. There's probably CPOs out there listening that are rolling their eyes at me right now, but I would offer a perspective that many of us have the opportunity to revisit the nature of purpose and mission in our organizations that then drives belonging.
So there are a lot of questions that need to be answered explicitly if you're going to be able to answer for each employee, do I matter here?
I can't think of a single time when I was in any interaction in my life, to include social events, you're at a party, and if you're feeling like you aren't additive to that event, do you really want to stick around? If you don't know anybody there, if they're not playing music you like, if they're not serving food that you like, or at least want to try if it's different, if people aren't kind to you, like, you don't want to stick around that party. Same with any organization. You want to know that you matter in that moment, in that room, in that conversation, on that team, in the company. And if you don't, people are probably going to vote with their feet.
So let's take that metaphor and bring it back to the HR function a little bit then. How can we make sure that HR's mission matters moving forward in organizations? And there are nuances depending on the organization and what's the leadership team that you're sitting across that you're looking to help enable. But what would you say now, like in this current era, right? We are where we are, right? There's a mix of return to office and end of ZERP and constrained budgets, probably across the board operationally, not just HR. But if you're below the revenue line, right, there's going to be more of a focus on constraints. So any thoughts on what will matter now and going into the future to be a world-class
HR? Yeah, I think I'll offer you maybe three perspectives, especially right now, especially today. I think that people functions, HR organizations need to focus on the criticality of authenticity. And I would say during COVID and certainly the days since, our ability to detect a lack of genuine posture or an ability to detect insincerity has increased. Now, I'm using kind words to describe that because there might be little ears listening, but maybe I'll use an acronym that our BS detector has gotten really good. Most all of us, right? We know when someone's trying to sell us a bill of goods, and especially in organizations. The resort has to match the brochure. We've all been on that vacation where we think we're going to this resort with the sand and the palm trees and the birds, and we open the doors to the room and there's like a parking lot or a dumpster outside. Versus what we thought we were buying in the brochure was like, oh, white sand beaches and the palm trees and the waves crashing. And does the resort match the brochure? And we got to make sure that's the case inside of organizations. How we're telling the story of what it's like to work here has to actually be what it's like to work here. Because people will either sniff that out before they get there or will quickly, again, vote with their feet if they find out it's not the case. So authenticity, I think, is a super important one. The second one, and this is a little bit of a pivot, but the second one is numeracy. People organizations are lacking in our ability to understand and speak the language of the business, i.e. financials. We've got to be numerate. Similar to how we want to focus on literacy around the world, people to be able to read, we have to focus on people teams being able to run the business by the numbers in every sense. There shouldn't be a whole lot of slides in my board deck that don't have numbers on them. If I don't, I'm not speaking the language of the business. So people teams have to become more and more numerate. That's the second one. And then the third, this is going to sound a little bit tried and true because it's a big discussion right now, but it's how are we genuinely leveraging AI to accelerate our business in the people function? Because that 3-5% that used to be 4-6% might go to 2.5-4.5% eventually. And maybe it will be called to be that. The number of candidates I talk to when I say, how did you use AI to prepare for this interview process? The number of them that go, and in my head, I'm going, wrong answer. I want you to have had a prep conversation with an AI bot that speaks about our company. I want you to have compiled a bunch of information, list of questions. I don't know, use everything at your disposal because our competitors are. So really making sure that we're leveraging AI in terms of scalability of the people function is super important. So those would be the three that I would say, authenticity, numeracy, and leveraging AI in a scalable and sustained way. Those are the imperatives. One of the ideas, to answer your question a bit more directly, how often are we bringing the voice of the customer into our people teams? And it could be as radical as an actual customer of the company's product. Now, you got to find a customer that's like, will you come meet with my HR team? And the customer's going to go, huh? And I'm going to say, you matter that much to us that I want the whole company lined up around your imperatives. It's that important to our culture. A, the people team will get a real good sense of what the customer cares about. And B, it'll drive real clarity for the customer about how all in this company is in supporting them.
And it also brings the HR team closer to the needs of the business and speaking, not just through numeracy, but also like in understanding the voice of the customer, which is what the leaders are probably also at least partially thinking about and hoping for HR along with everyone else to bring to bear. Numeracy is an interesting one because often people go into the HR function because they love people and they love interacting with people. And I have some weird friends, even amongst them, we're not just throwing math equations at each other when we're hanging out. That is an interesting point because I don't think it's, except for the people analytics function and to some degree in compensation and payroll, something that is a point of focus. And especially in HRBP functions, which is the primary kind of face of the function of interfacing with leadership teams, like you're thinking about EQ and so many other skill sets ahead of that. So that's an interesting one to call out that I just want to double down on for a moment. Okay, one other pivot, this other area I wanted to get into because you have a lot of experience here around mergers and acquisitions. You've been in numerous scenarios where there have been M&A events, and I wanted to just get your thoughts from an HR perspective. What does that mean to do your job well as a part of that process, pre-deal and post-deal?
I've been acquired twice myself. And during my time with various companies acquired, I think it's now on 15 or 20 companies that I've been involved in the acquisition process, whether diligence, the acquisition itself, or integrations. I've seen both sides of the aisle. And I would say that your ability as a people person, certainly as a chief people officer, to succeed in an M&A transaction, whether it's as the acquirer or the acquired, actually begins many moons before the transaction is even contemplated. And I'll give you an example. And this is a little pedantic, and it's really important. How clear is your job architecture? If you walk in and say, does everyone in this organization know where their role fits within the hierarchy, how they're moving along their career journey, how it's determined that they're a level X versus a level Y, and what's needed to get from here to there in the organization, whether it's lateral or vertical. Whether you're being acquired or acquiring, having a really squared away job architecture puts you light years ahead of so many other companies, because what happens oftentimes, in my own experience, is you acquire a company and you say, hey, let's talk about your team. And they pull some janky, busted spreadsheet that's all over the map with dirty data holes all over the place in it. They're like, here you go. And now I'm supposed to integrate that. Now, I'm going to do the best job I can in a very tight window to map and level those people to get them job offers. If you, as the acquired company, come to me with a hot mess of a spreadsheet, I'm going to try and integrate that into my company, and I'm going to do a decent job of it, but I've also got another whole job to do, and I got to do it fast. So the chance that your people are going to be put in the right roles and levels inside an organization, if you're not super clean when you come in, is probably pretty low. Two, if you're an acquiring company, how do you stand on your own two feet to say, Sally is a level X and Bob is a level Y? If you don't have your own architecture clean to be able to show it to the acquired company to say, hey, here's how we're set up, here's how we roll, here's where you all fit in. When that's really dialed in and done well, it is a huge sense of welcome and affirmation to the acquired company. It's like, wow, these folks have their stuff together. They were ready for us. We're joining a great company that's on the right track, that's on the rails, and we're going to do great things here. So it's a really interesting way that you touch every single employee in that acquired company when you do that, and it puts an idea in their head about how ready for us is this company, and or if we're the acquirer, how ready are for we to welcome that organization. So it's a pedantic topic about job architecture. It leads to so much else, though, because it gets into compensation, equity management, equity and equality, empowerment, mobility, like engagement. All that stuff happens when you've got a really good job architecture because you've been thoughtful about how you set people up for success in your organization. I would say if I could wave a magic wand at myself and others, it would be to spend more time on that in the organization before you even think you need to.
That actually makes me think of a fascinating question. So in the same way that CHROs are now more engaged at the board level and making an impact in all types of like decisions, could the analysis or input on the acquiring side alongside corp dev be so impactful that you're actually part of the decision-making process? For example, you have your stuff together and you've actually thought about the talent at the potential company being acquired and you come to some independent analysis that says, hey, maybe the valuation or the integration strategy, or that you're just finding all these holes that maybe the team from a product strategy or market strategy or FP&A level maybe didn't quite get to. Can we imagine that becoming an increasingly
Thomas,
important
role? I'm praying in your church, brother, because it's exactly the point. I completely agree. I think it does matter about the deal thesis. If you're acquiring patents, literal just technology to plug in, that's one thing. If you're acquiring customers or access to a market, that's another. Much of the time, if not most of the time, it's an acqui-hire in some sense that you're acquiring a set of talent that you otherwise can't get as fast or don't have access to otherwise in the market. And so it does come down to, are the people that we're acquiring in this organization going to be an accelerant? When we look at the number of M&A deals that fail or fail to reach their full value realization, oftentimes in the postmortem, it's because the people didn't stick around or show up or give the discretionary effort that we would hope they would to the new organization. So I agree with you. Having the people function in diligence from the start can identify some things, can highlight some things. I will say, looking back, there was one deal I was involved in, and one of the other executives and I took a pretty strong point of view against the deal. And for different reasons, and I won't disclose what part of the business that individual was from, but suffice to say, we were in very different departments. And we both said, this is not the right deal for the company. We ended up going forward with the acquisition, and guess what? Delivered a quarter of the value of the transaction. Not saying that I was right. I do think that there were some things that we were overlooking from both my colleague's point of view and mine, because we were so bent on acquiring a company because it was the right thing to do at that time, or we let one part of the deal thesis overshadow the whole thing. That having a balanced scorecard, if you will, of an acquisition is really important. Knowing that so many of the deals fail because the people don't stay with the organization, they're not bought in, we haven't explained the value proposition to them enough, we haven't planned for their engagement, we haven't mapped and leveled them in the right way. Those are all things that contribute to a deal failure. And at the same time, as long as we get 51% of them right in the M&A world, you're still batting ahead of most of the major leagues in that case. But what if we got 95% of them? Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. Okay. This might be a whole other episode we can go into, but it does crystallize a lot of the factors that we've talked about, what it means to be trusted advisor to the business. You have to understand the business. You have to understand your stakeholders. You have to understand the employees and talent, and you have to have a formalized way of looking at talent in your organization and what it needs to belong there. All those things have to be true for you to get to the point where you're adding value in a potential acquisition within your org. So in some ways, it's like the final test.
Yeah, if somebody from the outside comes in and lifts the hood or lifts the bonnet on this car, what do they see? Whether acquirer or acquired. And I always think about that. Would another CPO that I interact with, whether she's acquiring me or I'm acquiring her company, how do I look? Is she going to look at me and be like, you guys are a hot mess? Or is she going to go, hey, dude, solid, legit, pound, like nice work. Like I owe her that. And I think about that. That's what we owe our colleagues in the industry and we owe our companies themselves. We owe our clients inside the organizations.
Okay. One last question before we get into the lightning round.
Okay.
Bear with me. So zooming way out and thinking about the future for aspiring folks who are looking to get into HR for the first time or folks who are trying to get into HR leadership. Any advice for these folks?
I think it goes back to talking about how well can you articulate the agenda of your clients. And rewinding back to that, my first role at Salesforce as the HR business partner for the sales organization, I think what I did differently, maybe not better, but just differently than colleagues prior, is I brought the numbers to the table. So I was bringing analysis about the people in the business in a way that could be put on a spreadsheet in a slide to say, hey, have you noticed that our voluntary attrition among our less than 2-year tenured employees in the mid-market segment in the Midwest sector is outpacing the rest of the world? No one had ever looked at that before. Do we think that's a contributing factor to why the numbers aren't coming in that particular part of the business? No, we haven't looked at that. Okay, let's get to the root cause. Why are those people leaving? Oh, it's because they weren't attending as enablement training as quickly as the other organizations because their managers weren't empowering them to do that. They were actually telling them to go back in the market. So we were able to drive into root cause in that somewhat fictitious example quickly with numbers. And so I would say get to the numbers faster, and I think you'll see an acceleration in your career.
But in that example, it's not just the numbers. It's also understanding the business, right? All those layers that you talked about, like they work like this, they go to this training or they don't do that. You got to figure that out and marry that with the number. Great example, though. True to life or not. So let's get into the lightning round. 30 seconds or less to really get your thoughts off the cuff.
Okay. Hit me.
Tell me about a piece of career advice you've received that's sort of stuck with you.
If you're the smartest person in the room, leave the room.
I like that one. What's an HR trend you think that will dominate over the next decade?
The concept that the bots are not coming to take our jobs. The people using the bots are coming to take our jobs.
Okay. So there's, and it's people using the bots, right? There you go. So then if you had a magic wand to change one thing about the way the HR function operates traditionally, what would you change?
If I could magic wand, I would get some of these more modern HR practices going 20 years ago versus starting today, that we would have a legion of more accelerated HR contributors versus some of us are just coming along the journey and learning this. If we had started it 20 years ago, how much farther along would our businesses be?
Interesting. So you're looking forward to the future.
I think so. I'm trying to plant the seeds that the colleagues that I'm working with today, who will someday hopefully sit in my chair, will have the benefit of seeing a different way of leading a people function. And I get a lot of things wrong, believe me, every day. I hope I get a few more things right than wrong and contributing to hopefully what the future of the industry looks like that way.
Okay, and then last one, I'm going to paraphrase the question you asked me, LDK. So what is something that is not going wrong in your life?
There are those moments when you're working and you just look at yourself and you're like, I think I'm doing what needs to be done right now. I feel confident in the work that I'm doing. I think all of us have those moments of, wow, I am just like out to lunch here, imposter syndrome. I'm not sure I'm focused on the right things. And I think that's normal for all of us to have. The last couple of weeks, because I'm surrounded by an amazing team of colleagues and contributors and collaborators with me, I really feel like we're hitting the ball squarely where it needs to be for our company and in service to the business in a way that's helping it accelerate. And I think my team is feeling that way right now, too. And that I think that feels good for them. It certainly feels good for me in a position of servant leadership to be in service to that. So that's something that's going really well or not going badly.
That's always a great spot to be. And I think it's a good place as any to end our conversation here. Again, huge thank you to LDK for sharing all of your insights. And it's been a wide-ranging conversation, I think, about where HR and the organization in general is headed. And I think there's a lot that people can take away with the caveats that we've mentioned many times that every organization and stakeholder set is different. But all that said, thank you for sharing all of these insights. And I think it'll be helpful for folks as they try to future-proof their organizations and their HR functions. And with that said, until next time, everyone, this is Thomas signing off. Bye now.
Hey, it's Thomas again. One quick question before you go. Are you and your HR team tired of answering the same employee questions again and again in Slack? If yes, our Cleary AI-powered Slackbot is here to help. It takes routine employee requests and answers it automatically while freeing up time for you to take on more important tasks. At the same time, it automatically builds up an HR knowledge base as you go. It's quick to set up, works right in Slack, and you can try it for free. Just head on over to gocleary.com/HR-chatbot to install it. It's again, gocleary.com/HR-chatbot. Thanks again.